Trevor Zamparelli on 2FM
with Virgin Mobile. Go from scrolling through stories to creating your own. Freedom is calling. Virgin Mobile. Bring on amazing.
Now, I'm dying to talk to my next guest because my next guest's life changed completely at the age of 6. He grew up in various parts of Wexford and was expelled from school at the age of 15. My God. But the artful dodger of the literary world, as he's been called, is now on the bookshelves of people like Joanna Lumley, Jerry Halliwell, Vicky Patterson, and he's on the line now to just tell us how the hell did this all happen. Larry Mailer, good morning.
Hi, Jen. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. So I'm very curious to hear how a lad from Wexford went from couch surfing and barely being able to type to ending up on Joanna Lumley and Jerry Halliwell's reading list. How did that all happen? First of all, can you take us back to Wexford town?
And I can indeed. First of all, thanks for that introduction. I feel like Jessica Fletcher.
You absolutely are. So what was life like in Wexford?
Oh, yeah. I'm very proud to be from Wexford. So, yeah, I grew up in Wexford and was there till I was 17. And my mum passed away there when I was 6 years old. So it was just me and my dad from then. And me and my dad, to give a visualization to it, we were kind of like, I suppose, the Artful Dodger and Fagin. That was how I would describe us going around. But, you know, we just did what we did, kind of got through it.
Larry,
it was
a very difficult time. Larry, you were very young when your mom passed. I'm sorry to hear. Was it sudden?
It was sudden. We were actually living in London when my mom passed away. We'd moved over to London and we were there for, I think, about a year in total. But it was very sudden. She just was rushed into hospital and it was a matter of a couple of days, I believe. And she just, she had a massive kind of a blood clot went to her lungs. So she just passed away pretty quickly. So we were living in a hostel at the time in Holloway Road. And I just remember the police coming to the hospital, to the hostel, and my dad standing in the doorway with them. And it was all a bit of a blur after that. I mean, all my aunts and uncles rallied around him to try and get my mum back to Wexford. And so we moved back to Wexford then. And I didn't want to go back. I wanted to stay in London. I was loving it there, the big bright lights, big city and all that. But we went back to Wexford and then kind of tried to get on with things from there. My dad did his best, you know, he did his best. We was left with a little boy. And there was a big gap between our ages as well. There was a 46-year-old age gap. Mm. So, he did what he could. And, you know, it was chaotic at times. There was a lot of stuff involved in it. But my dad had a very turbulent upbringing himself. He was, he was sent to the Artane Industrial School when he was like 10 years old. So he had 6 years of hell at the hands of those Christian brothers there. So, he had his own demons and he was trying to get through life with that. It was pretty chaotic time, but he did his best and he loved me very much. I loved him very much. And
you sound like a right pair.
We were a right pair.
Getting up to all sorts.
Ducking and diving, hustling away.
Yeah, you say that. You say you were ducking and diving. You describe yourselves as being like Fagin and the Artful Dodger at times when you were growing up. Did that affect school life? I suppose it did. If you're getting up to all sorts of things, was school on the back foot for you?
Yeah, I mean, I put that the Fagin reference in there because there was such an age gap between us and everyone used to think he was my granddad at school, friends at school and stuff. But it did have an effect on school. I just didn't want to be in school. Like primary school, I was probably a bit of a tearaway, always in fights. It was hilarious because some of the lads said to me, like, they used to be afraid of me at school, in primary school especially, because one of my best mates, James Doyle, used to always say he only hung around with me so I wouldn't beat him up. But then I'd have the lads behind the corner. I'd grab them and we'd go behind the corner and we'd talk about like the Golden Girls and the previous night's episode. And I'd be like, well, you're Dorothy, you're Blanche, you're Rose and I'm Blanche. Do you know what I mean? So it was always like this kind of polar opposites with me. And then I went into secondary school and it just turned, the tables turned. I was very much quieter in terms of like, you know, I was kind of like a Jekyll and Hyde character, I suppose. I was kind of like the class clown for the most part, but I would shy away from any sort of fighting or anything like that. And like, I suppose some bullying came into play as well, because I used to hang around my best friends from Wexford are girls. They're like my family. Mm. And they would I would hang around with them, and that kind of brought a negative attention on me at the time. So yeah, it was all a bit of a mess, I suppose, in my head. But yeah, I just didn't want to be in secondary school. I hated it.
So you got out. Is it true at 7?
Well, I was thrown out.
You were thrown out. Yeah, let's be honest. You were thrown out at 15. Is that right?
Yeah, I was 15 when I left. I didn't do any exams or anything. I wouldn't have done well in them anyway, because I was barely ever there. I was suspended like 11 times and then expelled twice, which I didn't think could happen from the same school. But yeah, it did with me. And yeah, and then I just cracked on. I started working. And my aim was to move to the UK to get to London. I wanted to be a dancer, so that was my aim. I knew I was always going to do that. So I tried to, like, I just did various jobs in Wexford and saved up the money. And then off I went on the boat at 17, like Huckleberry Finn.
Off you went at 17 with 100 quid in your back pocket. £137 pounds in the back pocket. So not knowing what to be met with, or you probably didn't know many people there at the time. So you've not only found your way, but how did you end up writing a book?
Well, yeah, well, the book came about after my dad passed away, actually. So that was, my dad passed away in 2014. And then I was kind of at my, well, I was just in the midst of mental turmoil. Mm. I was definitely at my lowest point back then in around 2015. And I got diagnosed with depression in 2015. And I'd been to different doctors and I'd gone to a couple of therapies and stuff, but it was just nothing was really working. I got to the point where I was just like, something's going to have to give here. I'm going to either have to make a decision to change my life, or it's going to go the other way and I won't be here anymore. So I just made a decision then to give it all up, my life in London, my career, my tenancy, everything, and go travel the world for 8 months. So yeah, so off I went. I made that decision. It lightened the load when I made the decision. But then, you know, obviously with a decision like that comes a lot of kind of pressure and organisation. So yeah, I decided to do it because I had no other choice.
That's incredible, and fair play to you for making that choice. And so off you went, and where did you go?
Yeah, so I decided to write. So the writing part of it comes in because I decided to write a blog while I was traveling. And yeah, I started off in the Caribbean, then went off to South America, then Australia, then Malaysia, Indonesia. So I was 8 months away in total. But I wanted to see how my writing would be taken by people. So mm-hmm. I kind of did the blog, and I only did it in South America, actually, because I bought an iPad to do it on, and then realized that the blog website that I got wasn't compatible with an iPad.
Okay.
It was an absolute nightmare trying to find like hostels with Wi-Fi and upload pictures and upload the blog and edit and everything. But yeah, it was a bit of a nightmare. So I decided after South America just to keep a journal. So that's what I did. But the blog got a good following. So people were liking the stories about my journey and that. And then, yeah, so to go into the writing side of it, I was in Borneo and it was Paddy's Day and I was missing all my friends. And I was thinking, oh, I'd love to have a pint with the lads back home for Paddy's Day. But I was staying in this little jungle lodge in the tip of Borneo, and they had like a bar on the beach. And so I went down to the bar. I thought, oh, there'd be no one there. And I walked in and there was an Irish fella there called Alan and his girlfriend, Catherine. So, yeah, I got chatting to them, and Catherine turns out to be a writer. She's a really successful writer of, like, contemporary steamy romance. She goes under the name of Hazel Kelly. And, yeah, she and I ended up telling her about my writing, my stories and stuff like that. She was like, oh, you got to write a book. You got to put this into a book. And I already had that in the back of my head. So, yeah, so it went from there, from that meeting. Basically, Catherine ended up being my kind of mentor through my whole, the first book, actually, yeah.
That is incredible. And how did it fall into the hands of Joanna Lumley?
Well, I tell you, my Auntie Winnie, right? She just turned 90. I just went back to Wexford for the first time 2.5 years there in February. And it was for my Uncle Jimmy's 80th and my Auntie Winnie's 90th. And they had a party. And she's brilliant. She's just got such a lust for life and the way she approaches things. And she said to me when I was 15 years old, and it's kind of been my mantra ever since. She just said to me, Larry, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I just haven't stopped asking since. So when I was writing the book, I was actually sofa surfing. So I was kind of homeless and jobless. I was just doing like sporadic work here and there, a bit of labouring or bar work or whatever. And I was staying around different mates. I had basically a rote system going on. And then one of the people I was staying with lived near Joanna Lumley, I found out. And so I basically wrote her a letter. And I put it in the book and I thought, right, I'm going to listen to me Auntie Winnie here. If you don't ask, you don't get. And I didn't even know what house she lived in. This actually sounds a bit stalkery. I actually went to, so I picked the house I was nearly sure it was, and I just popped it in her letterbox.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then I didn't put too much thought on it then after that. I just thought, oh, you know, she might read it. She might maybe, you know, put a post up about it or whatever. But yeah, and then it was about 2-3 weeks later, I think, and I got this email. And I opened it, and I had a few drinks when I got back, and I opened it, and I was like, what? I nearly literally fell off the chair. And it was from Joanna herself, and it was such a beautiful email. And like, you know, I'd always kind of been, she's always been one of my favorite actresses, and the way she kind of does all her humanitarian work and stuff. I've always been very impressed by her. So to have her personally email me and to like really shower praise on the book was amazing, and she kindly agreed for me to use a quote from it as well for my promo. So yeah, that was how it came about, just by asking really and taking a chance.
That's an incredible success story. But a lesson learned, without being too stalkery about it, go and take that chance and go and ask, like Winnie said, and if you don't ask, you don't get.
Exactly. I wasn't at her window or anything, you know, peeking in.
Thank God. Come here to me. How's life now?
Yeah, life is good now. You know, I'm just, it's a continuous journey, you know, it's daily. Yeah. It's little steps every day. I mean, my anxiety just never sleeps. It's like I got to grips with the depression. And then as soon as I got to grips with the depression, the anxiety went through the roof. And I was like, oh, hello. But, yeah, I just take it day by day. I try and learn as much as I can, because the knowledge and the learning and putting that into play is very important part of just moving forward and giving yourself a chance, you know.
So, Larry, do you think you're playing catch up with minding your mental health after your mother died? I mean, it doesn't sound like you had any counselling or therapy back then. I mean, who did? Do you think that's all kind of maybe some of the root of why you felt like
It was definitely where it all began, for sure. I've delved into it and dissected it many times. And it was actually a junior counselor that I went to see. She was really good. She shed a different light on it for me. She described it as a layer cake of loss. This, I'd seen her after my dad died, and she just put it like that. And to see it like that, in that kind of, you know, like an actual cake, made me see it in a completely different way that I'd never looked at it. And that's probably where as well where the importance of visualizations came in for me. So I'm very big on like metaphors and visualizations when it comes to your mental health, because, you know, when it comes to depression and stuff, it's always seen as, you know, an engulfing cloud, or, yeah, you know, the black dog, or quicksand, whatever it may be. But it's always gray and bleak. And that's important to, like, you know, talk about it and describe to people how you're feeling in that moment, because it is very serious, it's very dark. But if you carry on with that, I think it doesn't help you. I think you then have to take control of those visualizations. I always do it like, kind of like seeing it as like a movie set, and you're the director. So like, you know, there'll be hundreds of images going through and around, and those images are like your thoughts. But you got to be there when it comes to the editing of those images, and like decide which ones take the starring roles and which ones get cut onto the cutting room floor, you know. And then, so I think the more light you can put on it, and the more color, and the more, you know, the more positivity you can put into these visualizations of how your mental health is, I think it helps. Definitely. It's definitely helped me.
Did it take you long to master that?
Oh, yeah. I'm still trying. I'm still working on it. Like I say, it's daily. You know what I mean? It's daily. I wake up every day and I just reset, basically, because like I said, my anxiety never sleeps. It's always there. Even when you're asleep, it's there. Like, you know, it can manifest itself into dreams. It can. And then when you're awake, its job is just to kind of pounce and to make you feel, you know, oh, you should be worrying about this, or you're not good enough to do this, or, you know, they're just constantly waiting. They're like little gremlins to pounce on you, acting like little bollocks. Do you know what I mean? So it's your job then to kind of like keep them at bay and reset and see, no, actually talk to yourself, be your own kind of, take control of the narrative in your head and talk to yourself and say positive things to yourself at the beginning of the day, so they don't get a chance to kind of jump in there. And you got to be the louder voice, I think, in your head.
And try and take control of those feelings.
Yeah,
absolutely.
For sure.
Why do you think this book, it's resonated with so many people?
the new one, the Mindset Handbook?
Yeah.
I just think the way I write, I always try to write from my heart. You know, I don't claim to be Stephen Hawking or anything like that. I try to write in a way that you don't need a PhD in psychology to understand. I'm just trying to share my experiences and how they've affected me and how I deal with them and what tools I use. Because it's in the new book, I talk about stuff that we all go through, you know, be it from like comparison to fears and judgment to how we react to things on the daily. And everybody goes through that all the time, you know, so I'm just trying to share my journey through that and my continuous journey with it as well, because I did feel a pressure after the first book actually to you know, be okay and to be fixed. And so, like, even though the first book was a very positive story and got a great reaction, I myself felt a pressure from it to, like, yeah, to be like fixed and okay, Larry, you can skip off into the sunset now with, like, you know, rainbows coming out your arse or whatever. So I decided to just, you know, address that and to get this book out there and to say, like, actually, you know, it's an ongoing journey. And the way I've written it as well, I want people to be able to just delve into it, to pick a chapter if they resonate with it. And if something does resonate and it gives them a bit of inspiration, then
dip
be able
in
to go back
out.
To it.
That's
yeah,
good.
Dip in and out.
That's
easy.
Good. That's great.
You know,
that's great.
I want them to come away with like a feeling inspired with kind of a renewed sense of focus and determination. Because at the end of the day, you can't control the thoughts that come into your head. You just can't. But you can control the focus. And that's the point of this book, is just to control that, to get to grips of that focus and to light a fire under your determination.
It sounds amazing. I think you've come so, so far from a lad who got, you know, been through so much as a 6-year-old, losing your mother, a very traumatic experience, being kicked out of school, and just everything that you've achieved. You're amazing. I wish you the very best of luck. Larry, thanks for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll get to chat again soon, okay?
Thanks very much, Jennifer.
Thanks, Larry.
Can I just say that the book's out on Amazon and on my Instagram, the links are there. It's sailors_sun. So, yeah. So thanks very much, everyone.
Anytime. Bye, Larry. There we go. So the new book is called The Mindset Handbook, as he was describing there, Little Nuggets for a Mental Evolution. Absolutely amazing. What an inspiring man and a fascinating story.
Jennifer Zaffarelli. Weekday morning from 9 on 2FM.